Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to our webinar today. It's entitled Diploma Please, Promoting Educational Attainment for DACA and Potential DREAM Eligible Youth. My name is Michael Fix, and I'm the president of the Migration Policy Institute. We'll start, as we usually do, with some of the rules of the road here. First, I want to take the opportunity to remind everyone that the call is being recorded, and the audio and the PowerPoint from the webinar will be on our website later today. The report is now available on our website at www.migrationpolicy.org or bit.ly DACA Ed. The slides and the audio will be available later today at www.migrationpolicy.org/events. And if you have any problems accessing the webinar, please contact us by email at events@migrationpolicy.org or call 202-266-1929. The best browsers to access the webinar are Google Chrome or Firefox Mozilla. If you have any problems hearing via the web, please dial in using the call-in information that we sent to you via email. We're going to have a question and answer at the end of the call, so please feel free to type any questions into the chat box on the left side of the screen as we go along, or email your questions to events@migrationpolicy.org. We also have a new DACA web tool we would like you to see, and it has estimates of the DACA-eligible population for 41 states and 111 counties, and we have detailed profiles of 25 states and 36 counties on the tool. It's available at bit.ly DACA Stats. Okay, with that, let me say that our speakers today are going to be Margie McHugh, the director of the MPI's National Center for Immigrant Integration Policy, Nisha Agarwal, the commissioner of New York City's Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs, Catherine Jin, co-founder and executive director, and Jose Ivan Arriola, training and community relations manager of California's Educators for Fair Consideration. Our report is being released by MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy that Margie McHugh and I co-founded in 2007, and we've focused since then on a number of issues that are at the center of immigrant integration, including early childhood education, K-16 education, adult education and workforce development. We focus on language access and access to public benefits, the governance of immigrant integration policy. The creation of a national office on immigrant integration policy has been a focus of ours, and we also administer the E Pluribus Unum prizes for exemplary immigrant integration initiatives. So now to the heart of the matter. What did DACA do? Well, in a word, the policy, which was announced on June 15, 2012, provided relief from deportation and extended work authorization to unauthorized youth who entered the United States before they were 16, have been in the United States since 2007, have a high school degree, or importantly, are currently enrolled in a GED program or an education or training program leading to work or a post-secondary education, a rather generous, sometimes overlooked savings provision written into the policy. The DACA program, we think, is notable because it's temporary, although it may be extended, and it may even be expanded as part of the exercise of executive discretion that's promised by the administration after the November elections. Like the now almost 10-year-old proposed DREAM Act, DACA makes legal status contingent on educational attainment, and that creates both incentives to learn, which is good for integration, but at the same time barriers to legal status, which is less good. But that said, DACA sets a lower education bar, a high school degree, than the often proposed and may one day be enacted DREAM Act that in essence requires 2 years of college. As you're going to hear, according to our analysis, only a very small share of current DACA recipients would meet the DREAM Act's requirements of having completed 2 years of college. Now, to the importance of DACA, which we think bears mentioning here at the start. In the first place, there's, of course, the importance to the DACA recipients themselves. It provides an opportunity to integrate at a critical stage in the life cycle. They can get driver's licenses, pay for school, work legally, open a bank account, and the like. We think that you could argue that DACA demonstrated to skeptics that a large-scale legalization program was, albeit with some stresses and strains, institutionally workable within the Department of Homeland Security. And finally, despite much motion, there is little movement. It remains the principal opportunity to obtain legal status in the absence of further executive action or actual legislative reform. So with that skeletal introduction, let me turn the floor over to Margie McHugh, our director of the National Center of Immigrant Integration Policy and a former executive director of the New York Immigration Coalition.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for that setup, and hello to all of you who are on the call. We really appreciate your interest in these issues and the efforts so many of you are taking to try and address some of the challenges and recommendations and the like that we'll be discussing today. So connecting to what Michael said in his setup, this report springs from the pretty simple observation that by tying immigration benefits under DACA and a potential DREAM Act measures to educational attainment, federal policies have made the concerns of the immigration policy and education success field very relevant to one another. So this report provides essentially a quick tour of the intersection of these issues, examples of some of the types of efforts that would help support higher educational attainment by key subgroups of DACA youth, and recommendations for meeting some of the top needs at the individual, system, and field levels that are apparent in many parts of the country. The report's starting point is that, all told, only about 37% of those over 15 who are potentially eligible for DACA protections had applied for them as of July of this year. And while there are a number of reasons why that number is not higher, it jumps out from MPI's prior analyses that almost 20% of all potentially eligible individuals didn't meet the program's education attainment requirement at the time it was launched. Also, at the time of DACA's launch, to the best of our understanding, only 5% of all potentially eligible DACA youth had already met the DREAM Act's college education requirement. These are worrying statistics since a significant amount of research demonstrates the importance of some post-secondary education to an individual's socioeconomic standing and life trajectory, as well as their children's. They also give a sense of the limited promise of DACA and potential DREAM Act immigration reforms without more potentially eligible individuals reaching the high school diploma and college degree levels. You'll see that the report provides a series of data snapshots that are relevant to the potential for education success efforts. Among them are a table on age distribution, which shows that over two-thirds of potentially eligible DACA youth are already over 19 years of age. This indicates that education success efforts will need to take into account that many individuals will already have transitioned to working full-time, setting up their own households, perhaps starting families, all of which make it more difficult for them to pursue diplomas and degrees. Also, almost three-quarters lived in families making below 200% of the federal policy level. Therefore, the cost of attending or paying for classes is a significant factor for many. Males are overrepresented in the pool of potentially eligible applicants, and particularly among those who lack a high school diploma and are not enrolled in school, indicating a need to consider program models that are relevant to their needs and career interests. And adult basic ed enrollment is down over one-third due to budget cuts made during the Great Recession, reducing what were already insufficient offerings in most parts of the country. So the report is organized around factors affecting the educational success of three key subgroups of potential DACA DREAM applicants: those under 19, those over 19 with no high school diploma or equivalent and not enrolled in school, and those over 19 who have only a high school diploma or equivalent. It briefly outlines education success challenges facing each group and examples of efforts and strategies to address them. Because many of the educational needs of these three subgroups would be met primarily by education programs and institutions, and since these institutions are bounded by complex sets of policies and funding rules that they can't independently change, The report discusses challenges and strategies for meeting more individual-level needs separately from program and system-level needs and also field-building needs. So turning to some of the needs facing the different subgroups, all of you who are in the education field are going to have to forgive me now for the next few slides where I'm scoping down huge issues and dynamics into just very passing references. But here goes. So for those under 19, the report describes key challenges facing many of these individuals, including the often poor quality of English language learner services available in many school districts, and a lack of access to the curriculum content necessary to meet graduation and high-stakes testing requirements. Schools these children attend are also often characterized by general education services that are of poor quality, including less qualified teachers, under-resourced schools, and limited access to school and career guidance services. And these youth may also have limited access to information on the DACA program's legal and education requirements. They also may face education success risks associated with their family socioeconomic status. These include pressure felt by many youth to work and contribute to family resources and more limited college and career knowledge, including information on scholarships and financial aid. So with that long setup, the report highlights then several strategies to meet some of these individual level needs. These include programs that provide targeted outreach and referrals at school sites that seek to train high school guidance counselors so they're better able to advise DACA youth, and also mentoring programs that help meet the need for ongoing academic and college transition support. And we'll be hearing more shortly from a terrific model of these types of services later in the call. So moving to the education success challenges facing those who are over 19 with no high school diploma or equivalent, the 1 in 5 potential DACA applicants who are ages 19 and over were not enrolled in school at DACA's launch and lack a high school diploma or equivalent. They're of significant concern to us since they face an additional hurdle in applying for DACA, but they also could be at risk of exclusion from the class of individuals permitted to pursue legal permanent residence under future immigration reform measures. So you'll see in the report that we sort of divide this group into two subpopulations, the first being those who have less than an 8th or even a 5th grade education and are more likely to be limited English proficient. These individuals seem to have arrived in the U.S. at a young age and gone directly to work. They typically would be expected to spend several years in ESL programs, several more years in adult basic or secondary ed programs, and only then gain access to high school equivalency, workforce training, and eventually post-secondary programs. It's an exhausting, go-slow process that's the focus of several cutting-edge reform efforts. The second subpopulation is those who have completed some years of high school. These individuals are thought to have attended U.S. schools for a significant number of years, dropping out perhaps towards the ends of high school for various reasons, including pregnancy, a need to work, lack of credit attainment, or failure to complete high-stakes tests, or a combination of those factors. So many individuals in these two subpopulations may not identify as DACA youth, and programs that could provide them a pathway to diplomas and beyond are often not visible in their communities. So strategies that are discussed in the report to meet the needs of these individuals include system navigation support, provisions to address the cost of program attendance, such as childcare and transportation, and program offerings that are more relevant to their needs, including basic education in their native language, perhaps Spanish language, high school equivalency programs for those with lower levels of former education, and integrated adult basic education, English, and workforce programs, as well as dropout recovery programs for those who are closer to completing high school diploma requirements. Then the last subgroup is those who are over 19 with only their high school diploma or equivalent. Now, individuals in this group have obtained their high school diploma, so they already meet DACA's education requirements, but many will face a difficult path if they're going to meet the 2-year college requirement that's been contained in prior DREAM Act legislation and which could likely be included in future immigration reform legislation. So we consider this group a prime opportunity at this intersection of immigration and education success policies. Most of them would be considered non-traditional college students, meaning that they're likely to be employed, low-income, parents of young children, and/or the first in their families to attend college. Many will require motivational and practical information about how to return to school and succeed in obtaining the advanced credentials and degrees that will qualify them for not only higher-paying jobs, but potentially also a more secure immigration status should DREAM Act-like provisions become law. So strategies highlighted in the report to address these needs include outreach, information, and navigation supports, expanded scholarships and financial aid, and relevant program offerings such as bridge programs that are specifically designed to support those who are not sure if they're ready for college-level work, English for Academic Purposes courses to help youth fill gaps in their academic English literacy, and learning community models that provide a range of academic and social supports for non-traditional college students, and programs like this are beginning to take hold on many community college campuses. So turning finally to system level needs before I talk about recommendations, I've spoken about a number, very quickly, about a number of forward-looking program models in my earlier slides about effective strategies and practices. So expanding these models and creating structured pathways through adult ed and training programs to post-secondary credentials requires attention to a lot of policy and system reform needs, and the report makes a real point of including these in its discussion. So these needs include system building and coordination initiatives that would align and make transparent the connections between what's usually a hodgepodge of disconnected adult education, training, and community college offerings in local communities. Scaling effective practices, including, in particular, integrated adult career training and post-secondary offerings that get away from the go slow sequential model of ESL instruction followed by other services that I alluded to earlier is another one of the key system level needs. Also, and this is, you know, this is another one of those glancing references to just an enormous field of activity. There's a range of K-12 improvements that are very much on the minds and in the work of folks around the country, especially improvements that have to do with instructional quality for English language learners. So with all of these sort of in focus as some of the big system level reform needs, the report provides examples for each of those types of efforts, but then it also, since it's obvious that to achieve them, local systems are going to need a combination of policy leeway, technical assistance, and funding support. You'll see in my recommendations that that we also talk about some of the field capacity building needs. So I only have time to provide a few of the report's top-line recommendations today. And this first slide, the ones I chose for this first slide are ones where there is really a very significant need and not as much effective policy or practice to highlight. So I thought they were particularly important to raise on this webinar today. So the first recommendation is around creating well-tailored information and marketing resources that would speak to young people about the intersection of DACA with education attainment challenges that that these three specific subgroups face. And really, I would say that the marketing materials need to be very explicit, because what young people in each of these subgroups would need to do, or the systems they would need to access, are all pretty different. And so, and then the second is providing guidance and navigation support at the front end of adult education programs, so individuals can obtain the information and advice they need to make informed class enrollment and pathway choices. We heard a lot about this in field work that we were doing over the past year. A lot of folks pointed out that we have that sort of a model very much in community colleges, acknowledging that there's a need for guidance and navigation support at the community college level, but interestingly, it's really not part of the model in adult ed, when one could argue that those types of supports, that students who are attending adult classes might need those supports even more than those who are at the community college level. And then also here, in terms of recommendations, we talk a bit in the report about expanding the provisions that would make participation in adult education and training more affordable for low-income DACA youth. And that's both, you know, that's both the actual cost of attendance, but also also sort of the lost, addressing some of the lost wages that individuals experience through attending, since the pressure to work is so strong for many of these youth. And then the final set of slide of recommendations that I just wanted to raise today have to do with program and field level needs. And as I was saying earlier, it's a real commitment of ours in doing this report to make plain that, you know, that definitely there's individual level needs that need to be addressed, but those needs are, and the reasons they aren't being addressed is because there's a lot of just a lot of development that still needs to happen at the programmatic and field levels for these various systems. So the first there is to support system coordination initiatives that would map education service efficiency and identify system strengths, weaknesses, and priority areas for investment. There are a few of these efforts underway in the country, but this problem of most of these services, particularly once an individual is over 19, and this problem of just a hodgepodge of services facing them, is one of the key needs that a number of systems are now realizing and trying to address. One of the nice things about pursuing a recommendation such as this, and actually quite a few of the recommendations in the report, is that doing so doesn't need to be simply an initiative based on focused on DACA Dream youth. Actually, these are in many ways mainstream system reforms that a lot of folks are realizing are needed, and so DACA Dream youth could either be the leading edge of some of these initiatives, or they could just be a build-out of existing mainstream efforts and really contribute to the conversations around effective services that many systems are looking to have. Obviously, there's a need to expand programs that are effective in helping non-traditional adult students obtain high school equivalency diplomas, industry-recognized credentials, and post-secondary degrees. And that gets to the two following recommendations around increasing research and policy analysis capacity at the state and local levels that could inform and raise the level of debates involving adult, career, technical, and post-secondary education, and also improving communication and networking across the immigration, adult education, career, technical, and post-secondary fields. So, within the report, there are some tangible recommendations related to each of these, but I think I'll just leave it there, and maybe just in closing, say a sincere thank you to the folks at Grantmakers concerned with immigrants and refugees. They provided support for this report, and also they're doing some terrific work trying to bring together the immigration policy and education success worlds in their own work. And, of course, that's such an important element in raising up issues that are at the intersection of both of those fields. So with that, Michael, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks so much, Margie. Next, we're going to hear from Nisha Agarwal, who's the commissioner of the New York City Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Nisha comes to her still pretty new office from working with Robert Katzman, who's the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, to establish the new Immigrant Justice Corps that offers legal representation to undocumented immigrants. She's going to talk about some of the very exciting things that they've been doing in New York. And so with that, Nisha, do you want to set sail?
Sure. Sounds great. Thank you for having me on this webinar and for MPI for hosting. What I'm going to do is just give you a quick sense from some of the slides that I have of the data for New York. But since Margie did such a great job of providing that context, I'll focus most of the conversation on what New York City has been doing in terms of encouraging and supporting DACA enrollment over the last few years. So as a starting point, sort of in New York City, to give you a sense of the numbers we're talking about, there are a few different categories of people who can benefit from DACA. There's, of course, the college students or graduates. You know, the undocumented students are often referred to as DREAMers, who in New York City, the estimate is there are around 10,000 of those individuals. Then there are the individuals who are already enrolled in school in the K-12 system, and we're and who are estimated to be around 13,000 in New York City. And these numbers also include college-bound students who are also often kind of referred to as dreamers. But I think particularly relevant for our conversation today are the undocumented high school graduates or individuals who have no college, who've either graduated from high school, may have an equivalency diploma, but have not yet gone to college and may be sort of working, raising a family in New York City. It's estimated there are about 17,000 of those individuals in New York State overall, an estimated 24,000. So we have, you know, tens of thousands of New Yorkers who are potentially eligible for DACA. Our enrollment rates have historically been lower than other parts of the country, and so we've really been trying to think creatively about ways in which we can encourage people to step forward to apply for DACA. And we've been very lucky in terms of the work that's been done at the local level. In 2013, the New York City Council recognized the need to build a support network of a combination of outreach providers, legal services providers, and literacy providers who could reach that sort of critical, hard-to-reach, out-of-school population of immigrants who would be DACA eligible if they were enrolled in an adult education program. And so in 2013, the City Council allocated $18 million for this program, which would be distributed over the course of 2 years. And here you can see the bulk of that funding, $13.7 million, went to New York City's Department of Youth and Community Development. And that was $6.1 million for fiscal year 2014, $7.6 million for fiscal year 2015, and a pool that was dedicated to outreach in particular for both of those years, recognizing that that would be one of the priority areas we need to focus on to ensure the relevant numbers for New York City. And then finally, $4.3 million of those dollars went to CUNY, the City University of New York system, to do education and outreach work. Our target population for this funding were undocumented immigrants between the ages of 15 to 30 at the point of June 15th, 2012, and who were eligible for DACA or potentially eligible with sort of educational enrollment of some sort, but with a real emphasis on those who may have dropped out or had no U.S. schooling. Next slide. So how did we take this funding and really make it into a comprehensive program? Well, one thing is that there was a dedicated focus on outreach, as I had mentioned before. Much of the outreach work was really driven by a local organization here called the New York Immigration Coalition, which is a statewide coalition of immigrant-serving and immigrant-led organizations. The Department of Youth and Community Development worked with these organizations to, you know, really do focused outreach, including in communities where maybe, you know, it are harder to reach groups, day laborers, restaurant workers, really providing both information about the DACA program and then referrals to simultaneously the legal and adult education providers who could help with the education requirement being met. On the adult education side, the focus was really on enrolling interested individuals. People were not enrolled in programs and screened for DACA eligibility necessarily, but there was outreach that was done through these adult education programs via videos that the New York Immigration Coalition created and that were multilingual so that individuals could understand what the program was and at least self-identify in terms of potential eligibility, and then through there be able to be referred to legal services providers who were also supported financially through this funding stream. And then finally, as I mentioned, there are legal services providers who would do the legal determinations, do the initial screenings for DACA eligibility. If a person came to them directly, they would then make the referral to adult education programs as needed. And part of the, I think importantly, one part of the program involved using the $18 million that were allocated to assist with the fees for DACA, which, as you can imagine, for many people who applied was a critical kind of support that enabled them to actually complete the application to the end. Next slide. So, you know, this again kind of outlines the range of different strategies for outreach in particular to the hard-to-reach populations, some of these things go without saying. The educational materials were translated into multiple languages, Spanish, Korean, Chinese, Haitian Creole, Hindi. Flyers and sort of education presentations were done around the city. New York has one of the most diverse immigrant communities in the country. And so, you know, in addition to language, I think being mindful of the need to actually work and partner with community-based organizations serving the many different immigrant neighborhoods was really an important part of this. The informational videos, but also really doing train-the-trainer workshops so that the word was getting out through existing community networks and through leaders in the community about this program, you know, using a range of different strategies, including community and ethnic media campaigns, radio, news, et cetera, to get the word out about DACA and its availability. Next slide. So the outreach efforts, there were the data that were collected, the outreach efforts reached approximately or just over 5,000 individuals who were referred to legal or adult education programs. The legal providers served around 1,500 individuals, and the adult education providers around just over 3,500 individuals through this effort. And the effort is, of course, ongoing because it sort of carries over into fiscal year 2015. But this past summer, next slide, please. This past summer, of course, we had the two-year anniversary of DACA and the renewal process beginning. And we at the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs were fortunate to be able to get a pool of funding from the Young Men's Initiative and supplemented by the Department of Youth and Community Development to run a large-scale citywide public campaign to both let people know about the renewal process as well as just know about the program in the first place for those who may not have applied. This is the first New York City government ad campaign that's been exclusively targeted toward immigrant communities and was really an effort on our part to keep the attention on DACA as many people in New York still had not even done the initial application, let alone gone through the renewal process. Next slide. So here you have some examples of the types of ads that we did. We had about 2,000 ads in subway cars, 80 in bus shelters in English, Spanish, and Chinese, and this is ongoing. I take pictures of these ads every time I see them on the train or on a bus shelter. A few things to say about these ads, sort of in designing who would be featured, who would be depicted, we wanted to make sure that the individuals in the photos reflected the diversity of New York City's immigrant communities, but also sort of reflected the fact that you don't have to be the sort of traditional cap and gown dreamer to be eligible for DACA. This is really meant to say that DACA is for many more people, working people, people who may have families, people across the board who may be eligible. And so that was some of what we were trying to capture with some of the imagery in the ads. Next slide. We also did a roundtable with Community and Ethnic Press, with DYCD, with the Immigration Coalition, and with some DACA recipients themselves to tell the story of how DACA changed their lives. We reached out to a broad range of ethnic media to also place do ad buys. So essentially the ads you just saw on the previous slide were replicated in newspapers in a broader range of languages than we were able to do the subway and bus shelter ads in, including Korean, Russian, Urdu, Haitian Creole, and Bengali. And we reached, based on the circulation numbers of these publications, more than 300,000 individuals. We also did radio ad placements in Spanish and Chinese on key radio programs. And I think, importantly, created a sort of centralized website for DACA in which an individual can read about their eligibility, also do an initial screening for eligibility, be able to get information in a single place just by typing in your zip code where those legal services providers and literacy providers are located that you can access that are right in your neighborhood that have been supported by city dollars, essentially creating a single point of entry to DACA information. And that URL is listed right there for those who might be interested. Final slide, please. And then finally, you know, the process we're in right now is getting, we created a mini version of our ads in the form of postcards in English, Spanish, and Chinese, and we're distributing them through schools and community organizations and consulates around the city so that we can continue, again, to have the drumbeat around DACA throughout New York City.
Presentation. Thank you, Nisha. That was an absolutely terrific presentation. And before I introduce our next speakers, let me just say that you can submit questions to all of our speakers, and let me also say now is the time to submit them. So our next two speakers are Catherine Jin, who's co-founder of the Educators for Fair Consideration. Catherine's published widely on arts and on education, and she serves on the University of California Presidents Janet Napolitano's Advisory Group on Undocumented Students. Our second speaker joining her will be Jose Ivan Arriola, who is a graduate of Santa Clara University, where he was executive director of the Multicultural Center of the University. So with that, take it away, you guys.
Thank you so much, everyone. It's great to be on this call, and I've been distracting myself by watching all the names of people from around the country on this call, and it's an honor to be around so many people that I respect so much. So I am the co-founder and executive director of E4FC. We've been around since 2006. It's exciting to be seen as being able to offer success stories about working on high school completion and college transition, college success, because our organization was really started because we were seeing so very little success, so few undocumented students completing high school, few of those going on to college, and then few of those, if any, being able to get to the finish line. Our mission is to empower undocumented young people, not only students, to pursue their dreams of college, career, and citizenship in the United States. We take a very holistic approach. We believe that education, career, and legal remedies are all inextricably intertwined. And we have three target populations that we approach in order to achieve our mission, and that is undocumented young people themselves, the parents and family members of undocumented young people, and educators and allies working with undocumented young people. Our family, as we like to call it, our E4FC family, are primarily undocumented college students and college graduates. These are the people that we make a long-term commitment to. We involve in our year-long programming, and we send out into the community to achieve our mission. But our broader community of students is much larger, and those extend down into elementary, middle school, and upwards. We have a very wide range of programming, including very robust legal services, focusing on DACA a lot right now. But today we're going to talk just about our programming that directly addresses undocumented young people's needs related to educational attainment. Jose, my colleague, is going to talk about our community outreach program that addresses undocumented students' need for reliable information delivered in person. Since DACA started, we've done about 600 presentations, reaching over 50,000 people through our outreach work. We also reach about 100,000 people per year through our educational resources just online. And then we have a number of different grants and scholarship programs that I'm going to go into. So I'm going to let Jose take over now.
Great. Thank you so much, Kathy. Thank you, MPI, and thank you to everyone who is joining us from around the country. My name is Jose Arriola. I serve as the Training and Community Relations Manager. I am undocumented myself. Came to the U.S. when I was about 3 years old, and I was very fortunate, particularly in 2006 when I was graduating from high school, to have been able to go on and graduate from college. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our outreach structure, our infrastructure, and our outreach efforts. When I first got to E4FC, it became plainly obvious that the number one thing we needed to do was to get out into the community and provide folks some information and be able to respond to both the lack of information and the misinformation that was present in our communities. When I went out in 2010, I was surprised to a certain extent, not too surprised, but I was still surprised that there's so many undocumented youth, parents, educators, still didn't know AB 540 was, which is California's in-state tuition law. And this was 9 years after its implementation. So we know that even once policies pass at the local, state, or national level, the way it doesn't always translate to on the ground level to our folks. And so we knew that this was something that we really had to do, and it's the same with deferred action. Once deferred action was announced, we knew that we had to get out into the community and really provide folks with a lot of accurate, comprehensive information. Now, our outreach efforts really rely on undocumented young people. We feel like, obviously, it's a part of our own organizational values, the values of the movement that we're in for undocumented youth, that it's undocumented folks who should be at the forefront of that. And so when we were designing the program, we really wanted to bring on undocumented young folks to go out and do these presentations, to go out and do this outreach, to be our kind of brain trust, to figure out what our outreach strategies need to be in all these different areas. Now, our community outreach is focused primarily on the 11 county San Francisco Bay Area, so here in Northern California. And we knew that it had to be in person, right, because this issue, the stigma that is present in our communities is still so strong that it'd be really, really hard to be able to get folks to come to something. We knew we had to come to them. And this was a kind of an interesting focal point where we got into schools and we continued to outreach to schools and try to get in presentations to students. And it was kind of an interesting relationship in terms of having immigration-related topics come into schools and kind of us witnessing what that process looked like. But as Kathy said, since the announcement of deferred action, we've done over 600 presentations to over 50,000 undocumented young people, educators, and parents just here in the San Francisco Bay Area for the most part. But we knew that it wasn't just information. That information was important, and it had to be holistic because we knew that this is probably the one time we would probably get in front of people. So we didn't just want to give them stuff on in-state tuition. We didn't just want to give them stuff on deferred action. When folks request a presentation from us, they're getting everything, whether they like it or not, whether it's parents, whether it's young people, whether it's educators, being able to know about Know Your Rights stuff, being able to know about local and statewide policies such as, the Trust Act or driver's license stuff or local resources around healthcare or mental health, scholarship providers at the regional, state, and national level. All of these things, we want to try to pack all of our presentations as much as possible so that we knew even if this is the one time we were able to get folks, that it was the most kind of fruitful presentation that we can in terms of information. But we knew that wasn't the only thing that we needed. It also needed to be coupled with inspiration and resources. So the fact that our folks were undocumented themselves opened up an enormous amount of credibility. They knew where undocumented folks were, so that really provided us an enormous amount. And then building on our community partnerships was huge. Being able to have us come into a particular space, whether it's a school, community center, nonprofit, college access organization, and to continue to come back to support that organization was really, really huge. And the final piece was around can someone move the slide for me? Next slide. There we go. Cool. And the final thing was the outreach ambassadors themselves. We've had over 80 folks go through the program to this point, and they're all, for the most part, undocumented. We do have some committed allies that were on the team. 64% of our outreach ambassadors are DACA beneficiaries themselves, and the allies have really deep connections as well in terms of having undocumented parents. But being a part of a group themselves actually helped their educational attainment tremendously, whether it was folks in community college that were looking to transfer, that saw different folks that were in college and really relied on them for help for transferring, or whether it's folks that were in college that were dealing with a myriad of challenges and really found this group, kind of our group, as a main crux for support for that, or really young folks just starting out in college, figuring out what's the best way for them to move forward. But then once folks graduated, we did have some folks on our outreach team that had already graduated from college, and they served a really great mentorship role for the folks that were in college to try to see how that transition would go afterwards. So it became an incredibly healing, incredibly transformative space for the folks themselves, as well as for everybody that were going out and serving. So I'll turn it back over to Kathy to talk about our educational materials.
Yes, I know we're running behind schedule, so I'm going to do this very quickly. So we knew that we cannot reach everyone in person. While we did think that was the most valuable way of delivering information and inspiration, we knew that we needed to reach a broader number of people, and that also so many young people were afraid to come forward in presentations, that the educators they were working with didn't feel comfortable calling them out or knowing how to identify them, and so we needed to find other ways. So in about 2008, we started creating educational materials that we could deliver for free online. We started with a scholarship list. That scholarship list is now national, and we have an undergraduate and a graduate school scholarship list for young people who don't have Social Security numbers or who are DACA eligible. We also put out a lot of guides about DACA, the California Dream Act. We have educator guides, parent guides. We do advocacy materials, and then what other people might not know is we do have also a creative writing website. We strongly believe in the power of storytelling as a way for undocumented young people to be able to feel comfortable coming forward, to feel connection to other undocumented young people, and to go through a healing process. And so for those of you working with young people and wanting to find ways to be different ways to be able to engage with them other than through their legal remedies or through their rights, thingsillnevershow.org is a good place for that. And again, all of that information is available through our website. We do offer quite a few grants and scholarships. From the very beginning, we recognized that financial aid was the greatest impediment that students felt experienced, even the students who were the most perseverant and had already gotten into college and even started. Many of them were dropping out in their third or fourth years because they simply didn't have the funds. We in California have given out about 450,000 to about 100 students. We've definitely combined financial aid with a peer community and advocacy. Many of the students who we support through scholarships, we encourage to share their stories, to push for institutional advocacy, as well as broader immigration relief. So they become not only beneficiaries of support, but they also go out and try to use the support that they've been given to be able to empower many more young people. We have a DACA mini-grants program where we've given out up to $500 Kickstarter grants for young people who've just been approved for DACA and have career-related goals. And then we have something called Invest in the Dream, which is a new pilot initiative that we started this year, which was a matching scholarship fund through which we gave out matching grants to scholarship providers. And really exciting for us as we are working with providers in states where we believe it's very difficult to do this work. So we have partners this year in Arkansas, Missouri, South Carolina, Colorado, Nebraska, Tennessee, Indiana, Oklahoma, and Utah. And really only two of those states are states where there's even in-state tuition. So all of those providers in those states have made a commitment to not only supporting young people, but really coming out as allies and pushing for broader reform. So that's a very brief overview of what we do. We welcome you all to get in touch with us. We're very excited to answer questions and direct people to resources that we know about. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thank you. So since you're eager to answer questions, I've got one for you. someone has asked about the DACA renewal process. Could you describe a little bit what is required and what happens if someone who's received DACA does not renew?
So the renewal process, we actually have a lot of resources about it. So the renewal process needs to be done within a very narrow window of time. I think that's probably the most important thing for people to understand, that people need to apply before they think they might be ready because there's a fairly significant waiting period. And so it's a $465 process. Again, that's also something that people need to prepare for. And it is a pretty straightforward process if nothing has happened in someone's immigration history, if nothing, or their status. A lot of young people are choosing not to return to legal service providers. We do view that that's an important step to go back and return to a legal service provider to help with a case and definitely to make sure that there might not be another remedy that might be at someone's disposal. I think those are the main points.
What happens if you don't renew, Kevin?
If you don't renew, then your work authorization becomes invalid.
Right. Nisha, I have a couple of questions for you. First, it's very interesting that you guys focus so much on adult literacy within your program. That's not, in many places, that wasn't the conventional strategy. How did you come to that strategy? What drove that outcome? And then let me add a second question to this, which is, the city has been doing a lot. Is there much activity at the state level?
Yes, so on the first question in terms of the strategy, I mean, I think some of it is what we've been talking about this afternoon, right, is really wanting to target the hardest to reach communities, and there's a kind of shortage in general of adult literacy programming in New York City. I think this was also an opportunity to just expand that and simultaneously sort of reach folks who could be eligible for DACA through this programming. So I think that was the basic thinking based on the history in New York City of the needs and then the desire to really reach some of the hardest to reach communities with respect to DACA. In terms of statewide, you know, we've been, there's a counterpart Office of New Americans at the state level that's been involved in doing its own outreach and engagement around DACA. We're, of course, focused on the city level and coordinate often, though, with the state actors on this. And the New York Immigration Coalition, which is the kind of main outreach partner on the city initiative, is really a statewide coalition that's been helping to spread the word and raise awareness and connect folks in other parts of the state as well.
Margie, I have a question for you and a little bit for me, which is, what research do you think is necessary to help undocumented and DACA youth to get into college and to succeed in college?
Okay, you want me to start?
Mm-hmm.
sorry to say that, like everything in this report, you know, these are pretty enormous issues, and you know, part of what we're trying to do with the report is have folks see that there's, you know, these are normally discussed in a siloed way, you know, the secondary, post-secondary, adult ESL, you know, all the different pieces of the system are often talked about separately, and there's lots of reports saying what needs to happen within each system, but I think most of those reports don't then sort of say, well, how would you make some of those things happen? And so I do think that first of all, there is a lot of research about the post-secondary piece. MPI has contributed to that with a few significant reports on state-level practices promoting the educational success of first- and second-generation immigrant youth. So a lot of the important strategies are in there. But I would say that it's still pretty much leading edge. Some of these more systemic reform efforts, and you know, we don't know a lot about what it means to undertake some of these reforms at a higher level, and so, you know, that might be an area that it would be interesting to hear more about what's happening there, because so much of what's good practice for non-traditional groups is good practice for DACA Dream youth. We know more about that, but we really haven't seen many efforts that are implementing that at scale. So I think trying to understand that better would be one of the sort of frontiers in this area.
I would just add that, you know, it's this program kind of missed it's a wonderful program, the DACA program, but it missed a major opportunity to collect data on the college going and on the transition from high school to college youth of the people who were approved for the program and applied for the program. It's very hard to get, there's almost no data that's been released on the population that is eligible for DACA but for having a high school degree and whether they went back to, what kind of schooling they went back to. We have no systematic knowledge about that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say, there's an interesting question here. Someone writes that the number of DACA potential applicants come to ESL and GED programs, and then once they get their DACA, once they get their approval, once their application is approved, they stop coming. Is there what can be done to encourage them to keep going? And Margie, do you want to?
Sure. I know everybody might have opinions about that. That's part of the webinar. I think I would say that especially as the immigration debate has become more deadlocked, and how the politics around it have really deteriorated in the Congress. I think a message to DACA Dream, DACA and potential Dream Act youth would be that it is possible that those without a high school diploma or GED would be locked out of any future immigration reform. It seems like that would be a very easy thing to bargain away, and we've already heard, I think that's been in the air, for the last year or two. And so I think there should be more of a sense of urgency, and I think that that when one of the recommendations in the report being around really targeted outreach messages, one of them would obviously be about the increased earnings, all of the benefits for an individual and their family of any additional education. But then on top of that, I think there's the real possibility of being cut out of future immigration reforms. That message really hasn't gotten out.
Very good. Do any of our other speakers want to speak to this issue? Okay. Jose and Kathy, we have an interesting question. What tools, how do you go about finding large numbers of undocumented students? What are your strategies for, if you will, outreach and recruitment? Is it just an intuition, or do you use empirical evidence? How do you go about it, actually?
Jose, we have many different methods. As I was saying, we do reach people directly. We work a lot through community partners. So people, most of our outreach work to date has actually been reactive. People have come to us asking for us to do presentations, and every presentation we do is a referral for 5 to 10 other presentations. And then we do reach people online. So people who are not comfortable coming forward and self-identifying will reach us online. Jose, do you want to add more to that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the primary, the most important thing in that actually is that we reach out to a very large group of folks. So it's not just undocumented folks. So, but even our recognition is that even if the people in front of us are not undocumented, they may have friends, family members, folks that they're connected to that may be undocumented. And so this information is just as relevant to them as it would be if that audience was undocumented themselves. In addition, it also gives us an opportunity to really make this issue very visible to folks that are directly connected to it. The other thing is that because we're so focused on having undocumented folks be our outreach ambassadors, because they're the ones that are leading this outreach effort, and because they grew up in these areas, and that's the biggest thing, is that when we recruit folks to go out and do presentations in the areas where they grew up. So they know where our folks are at because we grew up in those neighborhoods. We know whether they go to community centers, what events they go to, what educators are supported at what schools or at the district level. So really from the ground up, being able to understand, have a really good sense of the landscape from the undocumented folks that are from that area.
And, Michael, I would just say I think it is important when we say don't ask people to self-identify. So if we give an educator a guide, we don't say use this guide with someone who you know is undocumented. We say put this guide out on your desk and have anyone who comes into your office be able to see this guide for undocumented students. And they can take it if it's for them, or they can take it for a family member. But put it out where you put all of your other materials.
Great. All right, one last question. What's going to happen after Election Day? We've been wondering about this and wondering about what an executive order might look like and what it might include, and we don't know. But there are three baskets that we think will be in play. One is the parameters of the DACA program itself might change. They might do away, for example, with the education requirement, might, for example, change the minimum age, to move it from 15 to 18, might change the older ages. There's lots of ways in which the parameters of DACA could itself be changed. They don't yield many numbers in terms of the overall new eligible population. The other thing is to extend DACA to new populations, for example, unauthorized parents of U.S. citizen children, or maybe you unauthorized parents of U.S. citizen children have been in the country for 10 years or more. And then the third area that they'll be drawing from is if this something actually comes forward will be to narrow deportation removal priorities within the Department of Homeland Security. Anything further you'd like to add to that, Margie?
No, I was remembering that that I think we didn't say that this report is part of a larger scope of work for us, and that we expect in about 6 to 8 weeks to come out with a, you know, if this was a bit of a sort of looking at kind of grass tops type issues in this field, we're going to go deeper down in a report that will be coming out in about 6 weeks to give a little bit more of the detail of some of the particular programs that are trying to move the needle on education success strategies for DACA Dream youth.
Okay, with that, let me thank the speakers for their terrific presentations, thank the audience for their great questions, and for any reporters on the call who have further questions, you can call Michelle Mittelstadt at 202-266-1910. And as a reminder, the report, the audio, and the slides from today's call are going to be available on our website at www.migrationpolicy.org. And if you have additional questions, please feel free to email us, and we will email you back. Thanks very much.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.